This is episode 23 with NBL coaching legend Rob Beveridge. G'day everyone and welcome to the Blokecast. I'm your host, Brendan Hardman, and each week we bring you an inspirational guest or message to help you blokes out there live a holistically healthy lifestyle. Thank you for tuning in wherever you are around the world, and let's get stuck in. Talent wins games, but teamwork and intelligence win championships. This is a quote by Michael Jordan, and our guest today is one of Australian basketball's greatest coaches, and I absolutely loved speaking to this legend. He teaches us that in elite sports, as with anything in life really, communication, teamwork, and culture are the foundations of success. And with a career coaching professional basketball that spans some 26 years, 15 national championships, a couple of Olympic Games, a Paralympic Games, two Commonwealth Games, and two World Championships, plus everything else he's done in his coaching career, I think he knows what he's talking about. Today we get to hear the journey of Rob Beveridge, a bloke who I have so much respect for, and someone who I am so excited to introduce you to. As one of the giants of Australian basketball for the past 26 years, Rob has an incredible insight into not only what it takes to succeed, but also what it takes to perform at that level week in, week out. In today's sporting scene, there is such a huge emphasis on player well-being and mental health, and so there should be, to be honest. But there is a huge scrutiny on both players and coaches, and Rob takes us through the realities of dealing with that pressure, and more importantly, how it affects the ones he loves the most. Before we get stuck into this episode, though, it's time for Legend of the Week. And this week's legend is Scorro333333. I think I got that right. I think I pronounced that right, but we'll see. So Scorro, I'll just call you Scorro for short, gives us a 5-star review. And they say, working in the field of exercise physiology, rehabilitation for our veterans, these podcasts are enabling me to gauge a greater understanding of the male veteran, the non-communicators, the quiet ones, the ones that go off the grid and back on the grid. I concur wholeheartedly with what Dr. John said, that enabling a tribe, building a community of like-minded veterans, gives the social inclusion and a rapport back to these guys that these guys are missing in their civilian life. I endorse small group exercise therapy in my practice and enjoying watching my veterans get their lives back on track. So thank you, Brendan, for these podcasts. So far, I've listened to podcast 1-6. Love heart at the end. Most important part of the review. Thank you, Scorro, for your review. I'm so glad that that professionals are listening to this, you know, and that they're getting something out of this as well. And not only, but I hope you continue on to listen from number 6 or 7 onwards, because there's a heap of cool episodes in there for you to listen to. If you want to help this podcast grow, please jump onto iTunes and give us a rating and give us a review. If you don't have iTunes, that's okay. Jump over to Facebook and give us one there. You could be featured in an upcoming episode of the Blokecast as Legend of the Week. And you can also rest your weary head at night knowing that you are helping this awesome podcast grow. A little public service announcement for everyone out there before we get stuck into the content here. I am traveling to the US soon to compete for Australia at the Warrior Games, and I'll be in Tampa Bay for 2 weeks. I'll be posting a heap of content while I'm there, but I may or may not be able to cover that period with podcasts. I am doing my best to get a few up there. However, I may miss 1 or 2 weeks. So don't be alarmed. All will return to normal once I am back in country, and we'll just continue on our merry way and the journey of growing this epic podcast. Okay, it's time. Sit back, relax, grab a Matzo's ginger beer, whatever it is you like to drink, and let's get stuck in. Okay, legends, welcome to episode 23 of the Blokecast, and I'm stoked today. We have one of the NBL legend coaches here. He has been coaching for, I think we were just talking off air a second ago there, Bevo, 26 years now, but Rob Beveridge, welcome to the Blokecast, mate, and thank you for coming on.
Absolute pleasure. I really look forward to chatting.
Yeah, mate, I'm super stoked because when I reached out to you and said you'd love to do it, I just jumped at it because, you know, for people who follow NBL, you're a legend of the coaching scene there, mate. You've coached at, I think, three or four different NBL clubs across the span of that years. It's incredible. But 26 years, that's a decent chunk of time to be involved at the high level or high performance level. And from memory as well, sorry, just like pre that, you were actually involved in the AAS and those types of programs as well before you came to that level. That's correct?
Yeah, it is. You look back and I'm up in the NT at the moment. I've been chatting to people I'm humbled just to be a basketball coach. You know, you look back and go, I'm a basketball coach. And you look back in 26 years and you look at your journey and I've had coached 15 national championships. I've been at 2 Olympic Games, 2 World Championships, 2 Com Games. Just about to go to my 3rd World Championship, the Uni Games. And you got to pinch yourself at times. And when people say, "Oh, what do you do?" I'm going, "I'm a basketball coach."
And they think you're coaching a Sunday league team out the back.
Yeah, and it's really, really interesting. And I've done everything from the under-8 mini ball through to, the Olympic Games. And, it's very, very, very blessed to do what I do. And, I've had a wonderful journey. And, I just love putting back down. So I'm up in the Northern Territory at the moment working with Indigenous kids in the community. And it's almost, I feel, it's an obligation that I want to give back now. I've had a great career and it's time for me to give back as much as I can.
And I think just with the way that coaches are, their mentality and the way they're shaped as people, they naturally have that want to want to give back. Like, that's the whole point of why you coach, is that you want to, most of the time you're not really doing it for yourself. You're doing it to develop other people. Is that what you found over the years?
Yeah, I think the more you do it, you realize that I'm in the people industry. You want to win championships, you want to win games, you want to do that, but you actually get to a point and you go, geez, you really do have an influence on people's lives, and that's what I get out of it is how I can make these players probably better people and better players.
Yeah,
it sort of works hand in hand and stuff like that. And I think everybody are competitors and they want to win, but I'm definitely far from a coach that win at all costs. And I've taken different jobs in the past where I've been with the lowest resource teams, and I've done it as a challenge to me to see if I can coach, what I can do. But it's how I can actually influence people. And I've had a model over my career, over a long time, that I've learned from some other great coaches and mentors, is that it's not about me. It's actually about the athletes. And I do a lot of stuff with businesses. Like, it's about the product. It's what you do with it and the infrastructure that you put in place. And so no matter what organization I work with, it's never ever about me. It's always about what can I do to make my athletes better, because if I make the athletes better on and off the court, that makes the team better, which obviously keeps where success comes from.
Exactly. Yeah. And the thing which I think you touched on something really important there, is that most managers, that's a wrong way to put it, not most managers, but there are a lot of managers out there that manage people in everyday work environment that think that they're subordinates or workers, for whatever better term, that they work for them. And that's one of the key leadership principles that I I've always rolled with throughout my military career and then onwards after that. And same as you, when I speak to civilian businesses and stuff, is turning around and saying, they don't work for you, you work for them. You work to make them better people, because if you make them better people and you allow them to, you empower them to be able to make decisions and to be able to grow as people, then all of a sudden, you not only do you look better, but you perform better as a team.
Yeah, oh, there's no question about it. And, you know, I also look at my career has also been like almost a social experiment that I've had a belief of that if I show that I care and I show that I want to make them better, I mean, it's one of the things that I recruit players is I want to know who they are, what their goals are, and how can I help you to get there?
Yeah.
If they don't want to, you know, be the best or whatever, you know, I'm not interested in working with those types of people because my job is to make them better.
Yeah.
And I've worked with organisations where I've had dictatorship that I have my boss or whatever telling me what I should be doing. And, you know, it's quite ironic, you know, if you're an expert in a field, you employ people in that area to do their jobs. And it's when people interfere and they tell you what, they're not qualified to do that.
Yeah.
That there is, that's the recipe for being unsuccessful. So it's almost, I've been through the good programs, the bad programs, the rich programs, the poor programs. And to me, it's not so much about how much money the program has. It's about the leadership, about my boss empowers me to do my job, that they're there to make me better, to support me, to make me accountable and so on. It's when people, you know, are the dictators and say, you do this or, you know, my way or the highway, it just doesn't work.
Yeah. And then, so your coaching journey in itself, where was the first step? What made you think, I guess, when was the point when you went from coaching, you know, state-level basketball to saying, hang on a second, I can probably take this further and make a career out of this? And why did you actually choose to go down that other than the love of basketball?
Yeah, it's an interesting question that, you know, people ask all the time, how do you get into it? And I mean, I started off playing junior basketball and soccer. I was pretty good at both. I was in rep programs and I had to make a choice between the two, and I decided to go down the path of basketball purely because it was an indoor sport. So I grew up in Canberra.
Yeah,
so
yes.
playing soccer in Canberra where it was, you know, -5 degrees, sleet and wet and cold. You know, I actually chose basketball, you know, for that reason. It was an indoor sport.
And I hear you there.
So, I played under 14 club championships, and then I did the under 16s, under 18s, under 20s, and I fell in love with the game.
Yeah.
And then, like after under 20s, that's when your mates say, "Oh, geez, you know, can you be a professional player?" And I was realistic. I was really realistic about going, you know what, the chances of me become a professional player are slim. You know, you got to have your goals, but you got to be realistic about it. And I was really, really fortunate when I was around 16 years of age that it was compulsory. I was playing in the Division One team, and it was compulsory for our club that every single player that played Division One had to coach juniors. Okay. It didn't matter who it was. If you're an NBL player, so I had Dave Nelson, Gary Ball, you know, a couple other players there that played for the Cannons, they also coached the juniors, so they did it.
It's a great way to build culture in a club, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I thought that was fantastic. So I started off coaching like mini ball, like 8, 9-year-old kids on the low rings, and I just loved it. I just enjoyed it so much, and you know, I did that for a number of years while I was still playing, and then I made the decision. You know what? I'm not going to be good enough to be a professional player. Back in those days, there wasn't enough money anyway. So I made the decision that I wanted to stay in the sport. And the only way I could do it was by becoming a coach.
Yep.
So I really invested in myself. And I looked around. I thought I was really lucky being in Canberra, that having the AIS there, you know, the Canberra Cannons are around. We were really, really lucky that we had some of the best coaches in the country. You know, the Barry Barnes was there in the day, and there's Adrian Hurley, Patrick Hunt, and I thought, you know what, if I want to be the best, I've got to surround myself with the best. So I became, it was almost obsessive compulsive disorder, where I went to the AIS all the time. I watched them, their methods, and I hung around like a bad smell, really. And it was one of those things that I showed so much enthusiasm and passion and sacrifice, you know, used to ride my bike and catch a bus, or, you know, spend hours, you know, researching the game, studying the game. And then I went on to university, and the same thing. Everything I did at university was sport related. You know, so I ended up doing two degrees in sports science and sports psychology. And from there, it all just went from there. Massive on mentors. You know, I thought if you're going to be the best, surround yourself with the best. And that was you know, philosophy to this very day. I still believe in. And you know, I want to be the best, and I want to force my players to strive in their goals as well.
Yeah, and then I mean, this we look at you look at basketball. A lot of people, I guess, when they look at basketball, look at the NBA model, and they think that the world is a cutthroat environment. Is Australia, and I guess I don't know the answer to this myself, but is Australia the NBL, and when you're at that high performance level, is it as cutthroat as it is in the NBA, or is it a lot, I guess, not as like, when I say cutthroat, I mean like one day you're walking in, you got a job, and the next day you don't. And that's kind of the
So the NBA challenge. Is on steroids. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. They've got, you know, the marketplace. You've got 30 teams. It's all on TV. As I said, it's a multi-billion dollar industry, where in Australia we've only got 8 teams. And of the 8 teams, you've got 4 rich teams, and then you've got 4 of the, you know, the poorer teams, if you want to call them poor. But there's a big, big gap between the top 4 and the bottom 4, where the NBA, it's very, very cutthroat. The coach doesn't have a say in the players. The majority of the players and the staff, you know, everything over there is run by owners and their general managers.
Yeah, the GMs,
you know, all their scouts. They put the team together. They trade. It's a business. It's not to do with, you know, personalities. They're not people. They're numbers.
Yep.
And it's completely different from the NBA to the NBL. With saying that, I'm starting to see over the last couple of years in particular that with private ownership, that the owners are now having more of a say, and if anything, too much of a say.
Yeah, that's, so that's actually where the question was going to lead to.
So. Yeah, the coaches aren't having as much say in the team that now than it was. And I've experienced that. And so I've been with great management that you work with them, you meet, you discuss, you work out plans, and you know, it's a really good relationship. And I've worked with management that tell you what to do, who to play, things like that. And so private ownership has really, really gone to another level in Australia in the last couple of years.
Yeah. I mean, it's beneficial for this. I look at it from an outside perspective here. It seems to be it's beneficial for the game to grow, but then it comes with, like you say, it's all about personnel. It's about who you get, who's man, yeah. who the owner actually is, and whether or not they're going to want to, you know, impact in that way. I mean, you look at, I guess an example is there's a lot of I don't know what the actual, I mean, I know you know Andrew Bogut pretty well, but there's a lot of media going around that eventually Andrew wants to step into ownership once this is all done, once his career is over, which you mean, it's a smart decision for him to make, especially coming off the money that he made over in the US and investing that back into Australia's game would be fantastic. But, you know, the danger then of having an ex-player coming in and wanting the club to play exactly like it did in his day when life changes, the world changes, the sport changes.
He's had 13, 14 years in the NBA in a model.
Yeah.
I remember him saying that when he got traded from Golden State Warriors because they had to free up salary cap space for Kevin Durant.
Yep.
He said, if I was the GM, I would have traded myself as well because it's a business. So it's going to be really interesting because the NBA is different to the NBL. So if and when Bogut comes in more of an ownership thing, whether he goes with that type of mentality or whether he does go with more of the Australian model of we are more of a team and we have to work together. So it will be interesting to see how that does pan out there. But I've definitely seen over the last few years that the money that's in the NBL is really, really at an all-time high, and the owners have a massive say because at the end of the day, it's their money.
Yeah.
So I think it's their money, and they they keep the clubs afloat, so they feel that they have the right to come in and pick the team. And that's okay if there's consultation that's transparent.
Yeah,
I think
definitely.
That's pretty important.
Got to go both ways in the end.
Yeah.
Either way, though, it is still a high stress environment when you're when you're dealing at the elite level of basketball, whether this is, you know, whether we're talking at the Olympic level, where we're talking at the at the national level, whatever it is, the at that elite level, the stress every week must be, I guess, huge on yourself. Like it's you're responsible for the team, and so how do you actually deal with that stress of performance every week?
Yeah, it's again, it's changed over the years as well, and it all comes down to how much support you have from your management team. And I think accountability is so important, and I think all coaches get that. Over the years, the stress that you put under, probably it's changed with social media. I think social media has been arguably the worst thing that I've ever seen in over the last few years. The amount of abuse that I cop, my players, but even my family. You know, like my wife even has had to, over the years, change simple thing on Facebook. She can't put a name down. Like, anything to do with if she puts the beverage name down, she's been trolled. She's been,
yeah.
And that there creates more anxiety than me. I've become very thick-skinned. You know, as I've had done this for so long, I feel at times that, I don't care as much as what I used to. Like, used to take it to heart, but now it's almost I don't care, and I don't like that feeling.
Yeah.
And that's, it's a real thing. Like, I honestly don't care what people almost think of me anymore.
Almost like a numb.
It is. It's a complete numb feeling. But what pokes the bear with me is when they cross the line and attack my kids, my wife, my players.
Yeah.
Because, they're sitting on a keyboard, they're faceless, and it's created an enormous amount. That's what creates stress for me.
Yeah.
And then what happens is, the family always wants to protect. It's just a complete, it's a mechanism that we all do. We all want to stick up for your family and stuff. And when players get abused after a game, the family then jumps on, whether it's the sister or the boyfriend or to the girlfriend. They jump in and it just makes it worse.
Yeah, it makes it worse.
It makes it worse. And, I've had to try and ban my family from, don't read the forums, don't read the posts, don't read. But, some of the stuff, it does get through, and they're trying to help you, but in fact, it's not helping you at all. It creates more anxiety. But what it does, people in the clubs read it, like management read it. And I've seen owners that, will read social media comments, which is just the biggest load of crap, because they're not privy to all information. They don't know about what's going on in the lives of the players or the staff or whatever it might be, yet they feel they've got a right to abuse the shit out of players and coaches, and it does create a lot of stress. So I try and get my – don't even read it, don't even in it, do not respond type of thing. And I shut myself away from it
as much as I can.
But again, because of my personality, I've always – like it or not, I'm big brother or a father figure to my players.
Yeah.
And it's that instinct when they attack my players, they're attacking me. So it does become quite stressful at times, and you got to learn to try and deal with those situations as good as you can. And probably the way I do it is I've got mentors. I've got a psychologist friend of mine that's my rock. So they keep you level-headed. They keep you on the ground and teach you about it's only white noise. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So I've had to learn that over the years is don't keep it to myself. My network of friends is very, very, very small. I don't like to talk outside of that circle at all. And try and use them as filters as much as I can.
Mm, yeah, definitely. And then, so at the club level, in the elite sporting environment these days, how much do they actually have to manage players' mental health? Because there's a lot of, the way the media portrays it these days, and it's probably is true, that that 10, 15 years ago we didn't have these issues in sport, and now we do. And I think you're actually right that majority of it is on the back of social media and is on the back of every dick and
Harry. Mainstream media.
Yeah, every dick and Harry now has the ability to say whatever they want. And then on the other hand, every media outlet has the ability to report whatever they want without – without any repercussions. And you see it all the time. You rarely ever see a commentator or a reporter retract a comment. It just doesn't happen. Like they put it out there. Oh, that's fake news, as Trump would say. That's fake news. And then they just move on. They're just like, okay, who can I pick apart next? And
Well, I mean, I even look at it from the media perspective. I've learned to understand it, that, you know, if you read all the papers, you know, the front page and the back page is never good news.
Yeah.
You know, it's all negative. And what that does is it creates a fear type thing, and creates the environment. But what it does, it sells papers. It gets people talking. And, you know, I think they make money through negative media. So, I try and teach my players that's what it's about, that media can come out and say whatever the hell they want to say, whether it's true or not. And people are just going to jump on it, and you just got to learn to try and deal with that as well as what you can. But it's about understanding what it's all about, and it's really, really tough on the players. It's probably even more so on the partners of the players, because that's what really affects the players, and that's what affects us as coaches. And what I do with my players is I've got an infrastructure around them to try and teach them the skills. So I've got psychologists, I've got a chaplain, all programs that I set up, I have a network there. So whether it's a sports psychologist, if she can't deal with certain things, she'll refer them to a clinical psychologist, because we do have players that have serious mental issues. We've got a chaplain that can look after the spiritual religious side. I've got a guy that will help with their personal professional development. So you keep them busy through doing, whether it's university or further studies or whatever, it doesn't matter what it is, but we try and keep them all busy, because the more time they have on their hands, the more time they get to think. And so we try and have as many educational programs as we possibly can to help the players to deal with the pressures of winning, losing, social media, whatever it might be.
Yeah, and so it's essentially is in creating a network around these players that they can lean on something, because they have a tool bag they can lean on at some point to in case something goes bad.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's what the really good programs do, and that's what the great coaches do. They have programs in place to help the players. If you help the players, they will cope a whole lot better. And it's the clubs that don't do that sort of thing are the clubs that are always going to struggle. They're the ones that are always going to be towards the bottom of the ladder. And I've learned that through my ongoing social experiment of life. And, it's athlete-centered, it's coach-driven, it's administrative-supported. We got to help that person to cope with the different situations in their life.
Yeah, and I actually heard something on there. Because in line with what you're saying there, I heard something on the radio, one of the commentators for AFL was commentary around teams that come in and they win a flag, and then in the next few years they tend to not make the finals those for 3 or 4 years or 3 years after that, and they certainly don't perform at the highest level that they have done in the past. And the commentary was that if you have a poor culture, you can win a flag, but if you have a poor culture, you can't win a repetitive flag, because it's so hard to be able to stay at that level, at the top of your game, to be able to compete at that level, have all that scrutiny, if you don't have a good culture in the club.
The culture is critical. I mean, culture is the environment that you're in, and that's what, again, what I do is I look at successful programs. So, whether it was the early days with the Collingwoods, or whether it was with Hawthorne, or you look at the Wayne Bennett teams, you look at the Craig Bellamy, all of those coaches that have won multiple championships. I look at the NBA with San Antonio, with Golden State Warriors. You look at what those coaches do. They're people. They look after their players to the nth degree, and that's what the key to success is. And to have the culture healthy, positive, reassuring, backing the players, that is really, really good. And it's really, really difficult to try and get your players to excel if they're looking over their shoulder all the time thinking they're going to be fired. Or, you know, there's so much negative stuff going on, it's very, very difficult for them to perform at their best.
Yeah, definitely. And so in line with this, in how, I guess, stressful that environment is, how do you actually manage a work-life balance then? How have you done that over the years? And I assume that it's changed over the years and you've probably mastered it over, you know, being in involved in programs for that long. But how do you manage it now?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, you know, from outside looking in, you think, oh, yeah, you know, Bevo manages this so well. Well, no, I've had two meltdowns in my career. Yeah, and after Perth, when I say meltdown, it wasn't a basket case or anything like that, but you get burnout, you lose the passion, you lose that. You know, when I was in Perth, when you lose a couple of grand finals in a row, when there's an expectation of winning and you don't have the support of people around you, you go in a bubble, you go in your own little world, and it's a really difficult situation. And I end up having to take close to 6 months off work to try and find that passion that I used to have.
Yeah.
And it was a really difficult, I lost the love of the game. And I did take time off, and that's exactly what I'm going through right now. So after finishing up at the Hawks, I made a decision. I really did not enjoy coaching over the last couple of years, and there were a number of reasons for that I don't want to get into, but I lost the love, the passion of the game. So I finished up in March, and now I'm trying to refine my love of the game. So definitely not bulletproof. But at the same time, I look at it and go, you know what? I really am lucky with what I do. So I changed my mindset about, there's a lot of pressure, expectation of winning and all of those type things. But what I've found in professional sport, which has helped me, is you get to know people really, really well.
Yeah.
Like people, you're a professional basketball coach. Yeah. The amount of ass kisses that you meet in your journey of life is huge. And then when things don't go well, where the hell are they? So I've really developed a very, very tight inner circle of people that 100% can trust, that they're going to be there for the good times and the bad times. Majority of the time, it's your family. In my case, my wife is my rock. Unbelievable. I mean, I just can't believe she's still with me. It's like, because she's made more sacrifices than me, because, I'm the one that travels. I'm the one that's going away all the time, and she's staying home raising the kids and, almost forfeiting her career for me to pursue. So you become a little bit self-centered and selfish and things like that. And then when, you make a decision, no, I'm moving on, it really makes you realize there's a lot of false people out in the world, and it really has helped me to know who your true friends are. And they're the ones that I will always continue to rely on. When you're in a hole, you're always going to have a close-knit group of people. And they're the ones that I rely on, because I've seen the people that when I finish a job or whatever, I'm nothing to them anymore. Because they only wanted to use you for their own self gain. So it's an interesting journey that you might think, you handle things well, but I can categorically say, I've been coaching 26 years, but I've had two significant times where I've lost the passion for the game, and I've got to find ways of getting that back. And right now, I'm really loving being away from coaching at the moment, not coaching any teams. I'm just working, with underprivileged kids, grassroots, and I'm rekindling how I can put back in a different way.
Let's while we're on that subject then. So Charity Bounce is where you're working at the moment. That was correct, wasn't there, with the name of the organisation that you told me about? And so that's working with underprivileged and Indigenous kids throughout Australia. And so can you tell us a little bit about the work you're doing there?
Yeah, so... I was approached a while ago to do some work with them, just in Sydney and stuff like that. And in particular, Kevin White, who I love him like a son. It's one of these things with the players. You develop relationships with your players, and he's been working with them. He's the soul of the earth, and he's been coming up here to the Northern Territory for the past 3 years during the off season to work with them. And he's spoken about how great the organisation is, and the people that they work with, and it's just been an absolute pleasure. They've reached out and I've met with them, and they're just people that are here to help people. And I thought, this is just great, to come up here and go out into the communities, and it also sort of shows you how lucky I actually am. Feel sorry for myself and poor me, I've had a shit couple of years, blah blah blah. But then you look at, I went out to a community today, and just the love that they had within, there was about 120 people lived in this community, and they're all related in some way, but they were happy, they were laughing, they're in bare feet, they're playing basketball, they're giggling, I just thought, wow, this is just really, really special. And we're teaching them, to not get out of the community, but to say that there is a pathway for you to get away from whatever problems you have in the world, and really try and be role models for these players, as these young kids, the coaches. So I'm up here to coach the coaches, to take them under the wing and hopefully pass on some experiences to those guys.
Yeah, it's incredible work, mate. Like, the basketball team that I play for in the National League, in the Wheelchair Basketball National League, it's run by a company called, or an organization called, Outback Academy, and they do a lot of similar stuff through Indigenous kids. And they're just working in that environment, you don't actually understand until you get out there how much impact you can have, and how much impacting them has on you. Like, how good it makes you feel to be able to give back.
And to do it through sport as well. Like, Jerry Bouncer built a half-court basketball court in this community.
Oh, awesome.
So we're out there in the afternoon. So they've got the court down, they've got the basket. They've still got to complete it. But, there was at least 20 kids just on the court running around and shooting. And it was going, well, if they weren't doing that, I mean, they do that every single day until pitch black.
Yeah,
they'll be running around. And if they weren't doing that, they'd probably be in the park vandalizing or drinking or whatever it might be. So I was thinking to myself today, this is one community you put a half-court basketball thing, and look at what you've done.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if you did that with other sports? Like, obviously, AFL do a great job, but if we can get into all these different areas, and it's not only the outback of the Northern Territory or Western Australia or anything like that. That's Sydney as well. I'm looking
at suburbs there that really struggle.
Yeah, there's just not enough facilities in Sydney. Victoria do it well. Victoria have done an unbelievable job of building facilities for sport, where in New South Wales, you look and go, we don't even compete with the Vics anymore, because the government supports sport so much, and they're building 16 court stadiums everywhere. And then I look in the Western Sydney region, and there's next to nothing in one region where there's over a million people.
Yeah, and even then, with the resources they do have, you struggle to get court time. You pay generally, in most places you're paying over is what you should be paying to get court time, and just to be able to get young kids on the court, and to be able to, because the demand is there, but just that the resources, just they don't back that up.
Yeah, and the thing is, if we can get these kids into sport, whether it's basketball, wheelchair basketball, whether it's football, whatever it might be, from a social perspective, you're solving a lot of the problems of the world.
Yeah, definitely. And so, a tough question for you, or it might not be tough actually, but what do you think is your greatest moment, and then what do you think is your most challenging moment of your career? I'm sure you get asked that a lot.
Going back to winning the 2003 World Championship, I'll always look at that and go, that was probably my greatest ever coaching moment.
Yep.
Where You know, had opportunities to, you know, to coach Andrew Bogut and Damian Martin and Brad Robbins, Matt Knight, Brad Newley, Alex Marich. You know, the list just goes on. It was just an incredible group of players that, from a team perspective, it was just off the charts. It was the best team I've ever coached. And yeah. It was so special. And that there probably was the turning point from an international perspective. It put me, you know, on the world map. Like, people stood up and go, oh, my God, you know, who is this Rob Beveridge? And it wasn't about the ego, but it gives you a lot of self-belief that what you believed in actually works on the world stage. And that was probably the most memorable moment. And of recent times, working with the Scottish national team as well, because I've got Scottish heritage. My father's Scottish, my family's Scottish. So to coach a minnow like Scotland at the Commonwealth Games last year.
Yeah, I was going to say, that was at the Commonwealth Games, wasn't it?
That was unbelievable.
Yeah.
That it was almost like the Jamaican bobsled team. You know, like, there was zero resources. It's a country that doesn't really play. I only had four players in the team that were actually professional players.
Oh, wow.
I had four players that were in their early 30s that married kids, work full-time, play domestic. And then I had two kids at school, like in year 12,
yep.
And two kids in college, you know, like 16, 17, 18-year-olds. So it was to bring them together and have this self-belief of what they can achieve together. That was probably one of the most special moments. And, you know, arm in arm, you're playing against England and, you know, singing the flower of Scotland. It was just unbelievable. I mean, you get hairs on the back of your neck,
yeah.
You know, standing up. Those things is what, you know, I'll always remember. And then even going back to, you know, the 2000 Paralympics, when I saw the wheelchair team opening ceremony, 110,000 people. Now, you walk through those things that you'll never, ever, ever forget. And but it's all to do. It wasn't about me. It was about being part of a group that achieved something special.
Yeah.
And I think that's what inspires me.
And then your most challenging moment then, what do you think that was?
One of the most challenging was when I was coaching West Sydney Razorbacks. This sort of defined my philosophy on coaching as well, and about people was, West Sydney Razorbacks changed its name to the Sydney Spirit.
Yeah.
The Sydney Kings had folded, and so the new owner came in and said, okay, we're going to be called the Sydney Spirit, the Spirit of Sydney, and try and get all the fans. But what it did, it actually alienated ourselves from our own support network, yeah, of West Sydney Razorbacks. So we pretty much had no support at all, and we had next to no crowd at all. And then it was during the global financial crisis that the club folded. That the owner walked out, lost a lot of money, walked out. So I lost four players, and I only had six players that were actually, like, on the books, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I had to bring in extra players just to make up numbers for the team.
Yeah.
And we went 3 months with no pay. Like, the club was, you know, it was a choice of, yep, okay, fold up right now, change, you know, and finish off. But we made a decision. Myself, Sean Dennis, and Brett Coxedge made a decision, you know, we're going to fight here. You know, Jason Smith was the captain at the time, so, you know, very, very good leader. And we made a decision that, you know what, we're going to fight together. And at that stage, you know, I had a wife and two very young kids. They were toddlers, and they were actually in Canberra at the time. So I was living in Sydney by myself with no support, no nothing, no money, no anything. And that there was probably one of the most challenging things from a character perspective to find out who I was and how hard I was going to fight. And we saw the season out, and I don't think we won many games at all. I think,
yeah,
you know, we were doing really well. And then we lost nearly every game, but the crowds built up. Final game of the season was a sellout at the State Sports Centre, and the standing ovation at the end of the game, it really sort of made sense to me that what we did as a group was really, really inspiring. And
that's bigger look back, than you, and that as was well.
The most challenging time ever. I mean, to have no money, no pay coming in,
yeah, definitely.
And the only way we got money was from gate takings.
Yeah.
So, that was probably the most challenging time in my life.
A few more questions now. First one, only got a couple because I know you got to head off to a dinner tonight. But what advice do you think you'd have out there for coaches and for people who are looking to get into any sport, I guess, not just basketball, but actually looking to succeed in that area?
Yeah, I always tell people, serve your apprenticeship.
Yep.
Simple as that. You've got to serve your apprenticeship. I mean, just like in, you know, the normal trades, you know, if you're, whether you're a chef or a, you know, a sparky, whatever else, you got to do your 3 or 4 years and then you got to learn on the job. And what I'm finding is in this day and age, people want to climb the corporate ladder too quick.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I didn't do my first professional job, MBL job until, late 30s. And I'm getting people in their early 20s, oh, you want to be an MBL coach? Well, you've got to serve your time. You've got to find great mentors. Learn the trade. Don't go in too high too soon. You know, and don't jump jobs too soon.
Yeah.
Stay with what you do, become an expert in an area, and then each time just keep adding stuff to it. And but definitely find a very, very small network of very positive people, very good mentors that are prepared to help you, and don't be afraid to ask for help.
Yeah.
I think that's probably the biggest advice.
It's probably a great analogy to life, let alone sport and coaching, but yeah, it's brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if your career ended right now in terms of coaching and you didn't coach another day in basketball, which I'm sure you will,
yep.
You will get back to that, but would you be happy with how you've gone?
Totally. Absolutely. And that's exactly what I'm going through. So I finished up at the Hawks.
Yep.
And people, oh, yeah, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And blah, blah, blah. And I walked away from that. Like the weight of the world was off my shoulders. And thinking, you know, I said before, how lucky am I? I've coached 300-plus games in the NBL. I've been to 2 Olympic Games, 2 Worlds, or coming up through. I've achieved so much. And I can walk away with my head really, really held high.
Yeah.
And that's just the way I see it. So if I never coach another game in the NBL, water off a duck's back. It is what it is. But something that I have learned is that I'll stay involved in the game because I love it so much, but probably more so, what can I give back now? I've enjoyed working with FIBA over in like Indonesia and Korea, Japan, the Philippines. They're so passionate about, like when I go to those countries, they hang on to every word you say. They do what you ask them to do, and it's so rewarding that I try and pass on experiences going, well, this is what I did over my period of time where I had great success.
Yeah.
If I can do that, in my future, I'll be really happy about that. Right now, I don't want to coach again at this stage. Like as of today, it might change tomorrow. But right now, I don't have that desire to jump back in and coach in the NBL just yet.
Mate, it's unreal. So last question, which I ask everyone on every guest on every podcast I do. So what does being a healthy bloke mean to you?
Family.
Yep.
To me, if my family's happy, I'm happy.
Yeah.
I said earlier in the podcast that, what really, really pokes me really badly is when people go after my children or my wife. So it's one of those things. If what makes me with a great mindset is when my family are in a great mindset. And, when they're down, I feel down. So that's probably the biggest thing for me is I feel good about myself when the family's good.
Yeah, it's a great, great answer, mate. It's actually one of my favorites so far, actually, because I'm a huge family man myself. But mate, 26 years at the top level, 15 premierships. You got a gold medal in there from the World Juniors, mate. Your record, it speaks for itself, and and you're an absolute, but most importantly, you're an absolute legend of a bloke, which is why I love it that you actually came on here, mate. I really appreciate it. And so thank you, mate, from the bottom of my heart for coming on and spending your time. I know how busy you are at the moment, how busy we were talking about off air over the past few days, how busy your schedule is. So thank you for setting aside that time for me and actually coming on here and delivering an absolutely fucking awesome podcast, mate. I really appreciate it.
Mate, absolute pleasure. Yeah, really, really humbled that you reached out to me. It's very, very, very happy to be here.
Nah, awesome, mate. Okay, that was one of my absolute favorite episodes that we have done so far. I feel like we can all get so much out of that. There's so many lessons that you can apply to your own life. It doesn't necessarily have to be to something like elite sport. Elite sport is very, very comparable when it comes to just everyday, you know, life, and especially people who serve, who've been who are veteran, who've served in the armed forces, in the police, the first responders, those types of people, nursing, doctors, you know, these types of high performance careers, they relate directly to elite sport as well. And there's something so special to me in that, how Rob talks about how the key thing is, you know, communication, teamwork and culture. You build those three things and then you can start a dynasty from there. And that's what I love. And that's really what I love most about working towards building your own mental health and be able to getting yourself back on track. Those three things come in so important. They're just so important. You know, those communication, being able to communicate with your partner, with your friends, that teamwork, working with your partner and working towards as a team. So you're not isolated, not by yourself, and then creating the culture that you want around yourself. If you're struggling in life, start looking at the five people that are closest to you and start making changes. Start cutting people away that are bringing no value to your life and start adding people that do bring value. Okay, I'm so ecstatic about that episode. I hope everyone got as much out of it as I did. As I said at the beginning of the episode, if you want to be Legend of the Week, all you need to do is jump on iTunes, jump onto Facebook, leave us a rating and a review, and we will give you a shout out on the podcast at some point. And that's it for this week. As I said at the beginning with that public service announcement, I will be in the US for a couple of weeks, so I'll do my absolute best to get some episodes up. However, I may miss a week or two in the next fortnight or so, but we'll get back on track as soon as I'm back in Australia. Hopefully that won't be the case though. But just in case it is, I want you guys to know that I'm not going anywhere. Love doing this podcast. Just might be a bit busy. That is all with life. Okay. Thank you all for tuning in, and we'll catch you in the next episode.